Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Back in the 60s and the early 70s, one of the most popular books on spirituality to appear was a book titled Black Elk Speaks. It was a book that presented the story of a Lakota medicine man named Black Elk as told to a poet, writer, amateur ethnographer named John Neihardt. It's a book that was and is still of interest to people who want to explore spirituality in its many forms, and specifically Native American spirituality. One of the things that was interesting about the book when it a lot of people were reading it in the 1960s was it wasn't new. It was, in fact, first published in 1932 and was republished and became very popular in the 1960s. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking a bit about the book, about these two men, Black Elk and John Neihardt, and about why the book has been and continues to be so influential and popular. And our guest for this program is Raymond DeMele. He's professor of anthropology at Indiana University, where he's also director of the American Indian Studies Research Institute. He specializes in North America with an emphasis on Plains Indians. He was here on this campus about a month ago, and we were planning to have him on the program. And then, unfortunately, at the last minute, we had to make some changes, but we still wanted to have the conversation, and so we decided we would do it this way and do it by telephone, and he was good enough to give us some of his time. As we talk this morning in this part of the show, questions are welcome, of course, like always. All we ask of people who call in is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep moving along. But, of course, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to use is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, or even if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, at any point here, if you have questions, we certainly welcome people into the conversation. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and a toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor DeMele, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, David, I'm happy to do so.
Well, just some basic questions, I guess, to start out with, and perhaps one of the most basic things I could ask you to talk a little bit about is the man Black Elk. Who was Black Elk?
Well, Black Elk was an Oglala Lakota, Sioux, Western Sioux man who was brought up at the end of the period of buffalo hunting. On the plains, he was a little boy at the time of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, when Custer met his defeat. He was with his people when they moved to the what became the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in the southern part of South Dakota, southwestern South Dakota. He was an unusual individual in that he had been attracted to what he would call the spirit world from the time he was a little boy. Visions that had occurred, he experienced supernatural, we would say in English, or spiritual, perhaps is a better way of phrasing it, visions that provided him with insight and power from the spirit world of the Lakota people. After becoming what we would call in English a medicine man, a curer, for some time, he decided that he should explore the world of the white men. And he joined one of the early Buffalo Bill Wild West shows and traveled to New York City and ultimately to England, France, Italy, and saw a good deal of how the white men lived. And learned about Christianity, for example, then returned from Europe in just at the time that the Ghost Dance movement, a religious revival movement among the Lakotas, was occurring in 1890, which, as you probably know, ended in the tragic death of many men, women, and children at Wounded Knee in a conflict with the 7th Cavalry. Mm-hmm. The last of the Lakota conflicts with the U.S. Army. He then spent the rest of his life on the Pine Ridge Reservation as let's say, a religious leader. But early in the 20th century, he decided to abandon the traditional Lakota religious practices, and he joined the Roman Catholic Church, and he became a catechist and religious leader on the reservation within the context of Catholicism. Actually became a missionary for a time, visiting other reservations and teaching about the fundamentals of Christianity. And he probably would have, in a sense, died in obscurity. We wouldn't know about him particularly, except that John Neihard, who was the poet laureate of Nebraska, was writing a grand poetic epic that he called A Cycle of the West, that would culminate in the Wounded Knee affair. And he wanted to talk to someone who had been there, who understood the ghost dance and what the hopes of the people had been at that time. And so Neihard in 1931 visited Black Elk at Pine Ridge, and Black Elk told him not only about the ghost dance, but recorded his entire life story. And Neihard was so moved by it that he decided to write a book based on Black Elk, and that book became Black Elk Speaks, the life story of an Oglala Lakota. And in a sense, it was the first popular book that I can think of that actually presented in detail the kinds of sacred visions that were characteristic of Plains Indian religion. And so the book was highly valued by sociologists, anthropologists, students of comparative religion, scholars in general. But in a popular sense, it simply didn't sell. And so it went out of print and was not revived until a paperback in 1961. By then, Black Elk had passed away. He had been dead for a decade by then. But interestingly, a copy of Black Elk Speaks made its way to Europe, and a young man named Joseph Brown, who was studying in Sweden with Åke Hultkrantz, who's a great student of American Indian religion, came across it and decided that he wanted to meet Black Elk. So he corresponded with Neihard and then eventually went out to South Dakota and met Black Elk and recorded another book, a book that became The Sacred Pipe. And it was Black Elk's account of the traditional ceremonies or rituals of the Lakotas. So from these two books, we have an impressive corpus of material that tells us more about one particular Lakota holy man than any other source that we might have. So in this way, Black Elk has become a focus of study, if you will, for people who are interested in the traditional spiritual ways of the Lakotas.
Mm-hmm. So it was something that you can see why people would respond to it on a number of levels, as a biography of one individual, as a story of the interaction between Native Americans and Europeans at a very critical time, told from the perspective of the Native Americans, and then also people who were interested in mysticism, in spirituality, particularly Native American spirituality, that any and all of those kinds of people would find this book interesting. And I think one of the things that I think that this book is credited with doing is to get going interest among people in Native American spirituality, perhaps not when the first time it was published, but when it came back in the 1960s.
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. It hit at just the right time when young people here were looking for alternatives not just in drugs or music, but looking for actual, you know, spiritual enlightenment, if you will. I think that, you know, I was one of those young people who I read it when I was in high school, I guess, and was so taken by Black Elk and his perspective on the tradition of the Lakotas. And at the time, I was thinking about becoming an anthropologist, which I eventually did. When I was in college, I wrote to John Neihardt and told him how interested I was in the material and wondered if there wasn't more specific or detailed information in the actual interview texts that he recorded from Black Elk. Actually, his daughter was a stenographer, and so she took down a complete record of the conversations in Greg shorthand. And he wrote back and said, yes, there was more detail. He couldn't put it all in the book. And he allowed me to, as a student, then I was working at the Smithsonian Institution during the summer as an intern, he allowed me to have a photocopy of the typescript of those interview notes. And I found them just, you know, a treasure trove of detail. And I studied them for years. And in fact, I used little bits of them in my dissertation. And then I eventually brought all of that material together and made it available in a book called The Sixth Grandfather, Black Elk's Teachings Given to John G. Neihardt. And in that volume, I pulled together all of Neihardt's interviews with Black Elk. He interviewed him again in 1944, and there was a great deal more information there that was tremendously useful in thinking about Lakota history and the general framework of Lakota culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this. So I think based on that, the fact that you were able to see the interview transcripts and see and make comparisons between everything that Neihardt collected and what it was that then he chose to present in the books, this puts you in a and I suppose now anybody who wants to look at The Sixth Grandfather in a position to assess here just what Neihardt did as editor. And I think that over the years, perhaps, some people have raised questions looking at Black Elk Speaks, looking at that book, the book that Neihardt wrote and came out in the early 30s. I think a lot of people have asked this question, well, how much of Black Elk Speaks is actually John Neihardt, and how much of it truly is Black Elk and what he said, and did Neihardt add things? Did he emphasize particular things? Did he shape the story in any way? Or did he essentially take it down and present the material as Black Elk gave it to him?
Yes, that question has been raised many times, and that was one of the rationales for publishing The Sixth Grandfather, was to allow people to make that determination. Neihardt himself always characterized the book, Black Elk Speaks, as a book that had two authors. And when you read carefully the transcripts and then look at the book itself, and one can actually look at the drafts of the book as well, you can see that Neihardt was, I think, extremely faithful in his own way to what Black Elk told him. But he was not simply, you know, editing a transcript. I mean, he was a writer and a poet and someone who handled words beautifully. And as a result, he took the material and he created a first-person autobiography that has a tremendous power that, of course, the transcript lacks. I mean, the transcript is a transcription of Black Elk's son's English rendering of what his father was saying in Lakota. So it's rough. Mm-hmm. In terms of creating a historical narrative that covered all of Black Elk's life, there were some things or periods where Black Elk said nothing in the transcripts, and they had to be filled in. Excuse me. So Black Elk, so Neihardt had to go to other sources than Black Elk to fill those things in. So, for example, the account of the death of Crazy Horse comes from other sources, even though it appears in Black Elk Speaks. But he had no choice but to fill it in order to create his narrative. But he certainly invented nothing. There is nothing fictional in it. What he did, however, and this is, I think, inevitable, was to impose his vision of the American West on Black Elk Speaks. And his vision was one of the Euro-Americans coming in and essentially destroying the traditional cultures of the American Indians, a kind of manifest destiny, I suppose. And so he perceived the Lakotas as a tragic people who essentially had lost their traditional ways. And so the book becomes a kind of elegy for an American Indian way of life that's passed. And this is nowhere more poignantly expressed than in the last paragraphs of the book, which talks about the massacre at Wounded Knee, and it has the idea that the people's dream died there in the bloody snow. It presents Black Elk essentially as a kind of figure who was, to a large extent, beaten down by history, let us say. The epilogue to the book discusses the trip that Neihardt made with Black Elk to the Black Hills, where they go to the top of Harney Peak, and Black Elk addresses the six grandfathers, that is, the spiritual powers of the universe. And in response to his prayer, a small cloud comes out of the sky, and a few drops of rain fall. And so there is a kind of, you can read that epilogue as a kind of hope, or you can read it as a kind of finality of the end of the old ways. Mm-hmm. But in any case, Neihardt stops Black Elk's life right there in 1890, says nothing about what happened to him between 1890 and 1930, and as a result, he never mentions the fact that Black Elk had converted to Catholicism and had become a leader among the Catholic Indians on the reservation. So when the book was published, it came as a great shock to, for example, the Catholic missionaries at Pine Ridge, because Black Elk was one of their most prominent catechists. And then suddenly here's this book that presents him as a pagan, to use their terms. And so I think the book probably made a good deal of trouble, if you will, for Black Elk.
Well, I think that also gets at a question that people in who have read it and have thought about this and have tried to get some understanding of perhaps who this man was. The fact that he did convert and become a Roman Catholic, then they ask questions about, well, did that mean that he had abandoned the faith and the spiritual path that he had been on since he was born, essentially, to that point? I mean, how does that enter into the way that you think about him and his life and his commitment to traditional Native American spirituality?
I think that one can't answer that question without, putting one's own very personal interpretation on it, just as Neihardt put his interpretation on Black Elk. I'll just do the same for a moment. Mm-hmm. And look at it from what I think of might have been Black Elk's perspective. As a boy and a young man, he had been given these spiritual gifts, and they involved gifts of healing, and they also involved gifts of destruction. The powers that were given to him were given for warfare as well as for healing. And I think he felt a tremendous burden, and that is a sense that certainly the Lakota people had when they had visions. I mean, it was visions instructed them things they had to do on Earth. They had to use these powers. If they didn't, they faced the potential punishments of the spirits. And for Black Elk, it became obviously not a question of using powers for war on the reservation. And the powers for healing brought tremendous controversy with the Christian missionaries who were shaping, if you will, reservation culture at the time. Among other things, they provided economic benefits, and which were not open to people who were committed to that, the old forms of religious activities. I think for Black Elk, the conversion, to use that word, to Catholicism, that is to say, accepting the joining of the church and the practice of the rituals of the church, and coming to understand the fundamentals, mysteries of Christianity, was a way of escaping that old burden of saying, all right, I can't deal with this, with the powers from the six grandfathers, with the traditional powers of the Lakota world. I'm living in a new world, and here's a new kind of power that I can use. And my sense is that he, in a way, put aside the burdens of the old visions and took on a whole new spiritual dimension to his life. But when Neihardt came, he felt, as he said, in him, a desire to know about the other world. And my feeling is that what he did was to give that power, if you will, to Neihardt, and then turn it over to him to be his responsibility, to make it, as he said, go out to all the world. Black Elk felt that he had failed in actualizing these vision powers, and he hoped that Neihardt would be able to do it for him. And Neihardt was so impressed with all the material from Black Elk that, you know, he told Black Elk that he was going to write a book, and he hoped that it would sell very well and that it would make money and ultimately interest someone in Hollywood to make a movie. But, of course, those things didn't happen. So, in a way, Neihardt felt that Black Elk Speaks was a failure as well. And he then went on a decade later to write a book called When the Tree Flowered, which is basically another attempt to tell the story of the Lakotas, but in a fictional voice. And it's also a very fine book and incorporates some of the material from the 1944 interviews with Black Elk. But coming back to Black Elk himself, after giving away this vision power, if you will, to Neihardt, and then being criticized by the missionaries when the book came out, my sense is that Black Elk began to contemplate more and more why it was that the white people were so opposed to the traditional Lakota ways. And he understood very well that the missionaries said that those traditions came from the devil. And I mean, missionaries had a spiritual explanation for it as well. And as a result, I think Black Elk had the desire to explain to non-Indians that those traditional ways were not deviltry, that actually they were another way of reaching the spirits, of finding God. And he had the opportunity to organize a pageant in the Black Hills. It was a summer pageant that was aimed at tourists, and it 7 days a week throughout the summer, he and his group of fellow Lakotas from Pine Ridge lived in a teepee camp at just near Rapid City, They put on dances and I guess what we might call historical vignettes for the tourists. And in those vignettes, they showed things like the Sun Dance and Black Elk in his costume as a medicine man, pretending, you know, showing how traditionally he cured the sick. And it was you know, literally that. It was a pageant. It wasn't a revival. It was an attempt to show people what these things were like. And then afterwards, the tourists would mingle among the Lakotas, and Black Elk apparently enjoyed very much talking with the visitors, of course, through an interpreter, and explaining these things. And he did that for several years. And my sense is that gave him the opportunity to, to get questions, for one thing, but also to learn how to make equivalences between the traditional Lakota practices and beliefs and those of the white people, those of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And that comes to fruition in the book that Joseph Brown wrote, The Sacred Pipe, where Black Elk has structured the traditional religious rituals of the Lakotas into seven, paralleling the seven sacraments in the Catholic Church. And the book presents a very syncretistic view of Lakota and Christian religions. So I think that this is a process for Black Elk throughout his life that culminates in a kind of fusion or an understanding that there is only one spiritual reality and that there are multiple ways of reaching it. Hmm.
Well, let me again introduce here our guest, and we have a caller we want to bring into the conversation. We're talking this morning with Raymond DeMaley. He is Chancellor's Professor of Anthropology at Indiana University, where he's also Director of the American Indian Studies Research Institute. He specializes in North America with emphasis on Plains Indians. And we're talking here in part about a rather famous book, one that was very popular with people interested in spirituality generally and Native American spirituality certainly, a book that became very popular in the 60s and into the early 1970s. The book is Black Elk Speaks, a book that was first published in 1932 and was the result of these conversations that this man, John Neihardt, who was a poet, historian, amateur ethnographer, conversations that he had with a Lakota holy man named Black Elk. And one of the things, as our guest has said, that reading this book himself was one of the things that got him interested in becoming an anthropologist, and that as a result, as he was studying anthropology, he struck up a relationship with John Neihardt, who was still around at the time, and he shared with our guest the original, all of the material that he collected, all of the original notes of the interviews that he did with Black Elk back in 1930. So that there could be perhaps one of the things that he did that our guest here was able to do is make some comparisons between all of the source material and what was eventually published. And he has collected all of that together and published that as a book. Raymond DeMaley published that as a book in 1984. That book is The Sixth Grandfather. So if you're interested in reading some more about these two men, looking at the original source material and the book that eventually became Black Elk Speaks, you can seek that book out, Sixth Grandfather. And also, if you have questions, you can call. And we do have someone here who is ready to go on our line number one, someone listening in Gibson City. So why don't we talk with them? Line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I am just really fascinated. My mother is part Native American. She's part Ojibwe, and of course she was brought up in the white world, and she married my dad, who is a white man, and I grew up basically in a white world. And it's just since I've gotten older, I've really appreciated my Native American heritage. And I work with a group, actually it's a Christian group, and we have worked with First Nations people both in Canada and the Native Americans and in our country. And I just really been fascinated by the Native American spirituality. And I just want to know how you feel in your works about how Christianity and Native American spirituality kind of parallel each other. And I can see why they would become Christians. I know there's other factors, including, like you commented earlier about, you know, it meant food on the table. And I would like to know where I could get this book, because we are always encouraged to read as many books as we can on a when we go on a project. And for some reason, this book has skipped me, and I'm so glad I have a chance to hear your story, and I'm going to definitely get the book. And I'll hang up and listen.
All
right. Thank you so much for what you've done.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, I know, certainly, Professor DeMaley, that Black Elk Speaks is still in print. If people want to read that book, they can certainly find it.
Yes. So is the Sixth Grandfather. There's actually a large literature now on Black Elk, and there's a very nice book by Hilda Neihardt, the daughter of John Neihardt, who accompanied him on his visits to Black Elk, in which she gives her reminiscences about the visits and some very nice photographs and whatnot. If you just look on the web or under Black Elk, you'll
find a lot of stuff.
A large number of books, including a big website in which you can read a great deal of material.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in the caller and her talking about perhaps connections between Native American religion and Christianity. I think that the reason that so many people have been interested in Black Elk and Black Elk Speaks is because they felt that there was something important of a spiritual nature to be said here, that said something about the commonality of the experience and between spiritual traditions. And at the same time, I have also talked with people who have said, you know, they've looked at Black Elk, and perhaps this is in the nature of mysticism, but they've read it, and particularly the parts where he talks about his visions, and they just kind of shrug their shoulders and say, what is this about? If I asked you a question like, is it possible to distill in a simple way what you would think the message is in this book, or perhaps the thing that people the people have identified with, what would, do you think that would be?
Well, I think we would have to conceptualize spirituality as a cultural phenomenon. In other words, in every different culture, there's going to be a different way of apprehending the spiritual. And for believers, there is no doubt that the spiritual level, if you will, exists. But if you come from Lakota culture as opposed to coming from the Ojibwe culture, or if you come from a Catholic background or, a Jewish background or whatever, I mean, you're going to appreciate that sense of the spiritual in a different manner. And for the Lakotas, obviously they traditionally lived on the Great Plains, very, very, as we would say, close to nature. I mean, they didn't have, you know, big buildings, or living in the buffalo hide teepees, and so they are very much attuned to every change in the weather, to the growth of every plant, to the life cycle of the animals, to the nature of the celestial phenomena, and they observed those things very closely, historically, and they saw in them the animating powers of the universe, and as a result, they incorporated in their visions what we would call nature. The powers of thunder and lightning, for example, of hail, rain. And all of these things are things that we have pushed to the background as we sit here in our houses and office buildings. And we reserve them for, you know, those trips when we go out into the national parks or countryside or whatever, for many of us. And so what Lakota spirituality offers, I think, in part, is a reincorporation of nature into man's spiritual longing. And it does it in a way that is, if I may phrase it this way, that is very American. I mean, it's indigenous to North America. And I think it has tremendous appeal to us non-Indians. It certainly resonated in the 60s with the ecological movement and, you know, the countercultural movement and whatnot. So I think that that's a good part of it. We're all searching, and there's a kind of a comfort in finding right outside our window, as it were, sources of spiritual, if not enlightenment, at least of spiritual satisfaction. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I would say so, yeah. We have another caller here, and we'd like to bring them in, so let's do that. This is in number bonus, line number two right here.
Hi.
Hello. Yes.
Hi. This is something completely different compared to what you've just been talking about. I was at the University of Missouri in the early 60s when Dr. Neihardt was teaching there. He taught a couple of courses in Black Elk Speaks. And he was probably the most famous person on campus at the time. Although this was before the 60s and before the sensitivity to that kind of stuff. But he was very short, and he would walk around campus wearing just a shirt and tie. He had silver hair that curled up in the back of his collar, and there was always a little sensation, you know, as he would walk by, and people would say, "Oh, that's John Neihardt." And he had kind of a stern expression, but he was rumored to be an easy grader, and for that reason, a certain number of people took his course. So that's just a little bit of color commentary on John Neihardt.
And you took his course?
I did not. I regret I never did.
Well, anything you want to, Professor DeMaley, you spent some time with him?
No, I never met him.
Oh,
unfortunately, as I say, we corresponded, but I never actually met him. I know that the some version of his course, which is based on his Cycle of the West, was videotaped, and I understand that it's still available at the University of Missouri.
Hmm.
It's interesting that, you know, Neihardt was very much of a figure, let us say, from the 20s when he first became Poet Laureate of Nebraska up until, you know, his older years when he was at the University of Missouri. But there is now a museum in the town where he grew up, Bancroft, Nebraska. It's, I guess, part of the State Historical Society complex. And there is a very active, small but very active group of people there who maintain exhibits relating to Neihardt. And there are some objects from Black Elk that are on display there. They have seminars and other events. And they have a recreation of something that Neihardt had built for himself, I guess, down in Missouri, which is what he called a Sioux prayer garden, essentially a circular garden representing the world, with two roads, one going north and south and one going east and west, with a tree, flowering tree, planted in the middle, a dogwood, I believe, something like that. It's beautiful when it's in bloom, and it represents in a physical form Black Elk's vision. So it's a really interesting site to visit, and one can see, one can go to Neihardt's studio where he did much of his writing in his earlier years, and get a real sense of the man.
Well, again, I appreciate the comment of the caller. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Raymond DeMele. He's professor of anthropology. He's also director of the American Indian Studies Research Institute at Indiana University. And 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. It's my understanding that some of the things that, many of the things that Black Elk told John Neihardt, he had never told anyone. And I suppose some people might be surprised that he would, that Black Elk would have chosen to pass on all of this information about his life, his experiences, and about Lakota ritual to someone who is not Lakota. Do we know anything about what Black Elk thought about Neihardt? Was it just the fact that the fact that Neihardt showed up and was interested that Black Elk thought, well, the person is here, there must be some reason that he's here, and so it's appropriate for me to pass this on to him?
Well, certainly Neihardt wasn't the only person to have approached Black Elk. So it seems obvious that Black Elk felt that there was something about Neihardt that that was special. Neihardt first went to visit Black Elk in 1930, accompanied by his son. He simply went to meet him. And he went to meet someone who was involved in the ghost dance. And at the agency at Pine Ridge, they recommended that he go and talk to Black Elk. And when Neihardt arrived at Black Elk's house, he said he had the uncanny feeling that this old man was waiting for him. And they sat down together and began to talk, I assume through an interpreter. I'm not sure who that interpreter was. Probably a flying hawk who accompanied him from the agency. But anyway, they began to trade stories. And Neihardt explained that when he was a little boy, he had had a dream. And in the dream, he saw himself flying through space with his arms outstretched. And then Black Elk gave him an interpretation of that dream and said, well, that was your ghostly brother that was calling you. And they exchanged what would appear to be a rather mystical conversation. And then Black Elk said, according to Neihardt, I feel in this man a strong desire to learn about the other world, and I will teach him. And so he told Neihardt that if he would return in the spring, he would be prepared to tell him about his life. And so Neihardt went back to Missouri and then returned to Pine Ridge the next spring, as I say, with his daughter Enid, who was a stenographer, and his daughter Hilda, who came along for the excitement of it, I guess. When they got there, they discovered that Black Elk had made a very large production of this. They had put up a teepee for the Neihardts to stay in. The teepee was painted with the various designs of Black Elk's vision, and they gave that teepee to Neihardt when he left. They had pretty much made it a community affair that this white man was coming to record Black Elk's life story. And so it required feasting and a lot of sharing of things like games and whatnot, and culminated in an adoption ceremony in which Black Elk adopted Neihardt and his children and gave them Lakota names. Hmm. So I think there was a very a sense of what we could say mystical or we could say spiritual connection between Black Elk and Neihardt from the very first moment that they met. And this is part of what gives me the sense that Black Elk saw in Neihardt someone that he could turn over this burden of his visions to and hope that that person would be able to do something with it. The fact that he was non-Indian, I think, is irrelevant.
We're coming down to the last few minutes. I have a couple of callers. If we can, we'll get at least one, and if not both. This person is in Spring Bay. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I've always felt that the popularity of the book Black Elk gave rise to some other books, such as Lame Deer, Seeker Visions, and then maybe the Don Juan books. I was wondering if you could give a quick comparative of maybe some of those other stories of, Anglos going and finding out about Indian wisdom or native wisdom, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
I think it's certainly true that the success of Black Elk Speaks drew other people to tell the life stories of other Lakota religious leaders of the generation following Black Elk. So we have the biography of Frank Fool's Crow, and autobiography, I should say, told to Thomas Males, and then we have the one on Lame Deer told to Richard Erdos, and there's a couple on Crow Dog. All of these things actually provide a surprisingly large body of information about 20th century Lakota spiritual and ritual life. I think that in the future, we're going to look back on this, and there'll be all kinds of interesting studies that show the development and changes over time of Lakota spiritual concepts, because, of course, it's not ending. I mean, these books now feed into an ongoing tradition.
All right. Well, real quick, we'll see if we can do here line number 1 in Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. Interesting that he said Anglos, because I was sort of trying to formulate a question about, you mentioned there was a Swedish anthropologist that was also interested. Did you examine the kind of body of study and discourse that was generated by that? And I mean, there is a preoccupation in Europe with Native Americans affected the Swazant Witarders, just like it did here. So I don't know if that's a good note to end on, but I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Professor Hulkrantz worked with the Shoshone Indians, and he was a well-known student of comparative religion, and so there were a number of Americans who went to study with him, Joseph Brown being one of them, and his students have produced a substantial body of material on American Indian religions that has contributed very importantly to the record. It's a topic that is represented in the literature and anthropology and comparative religion, and a field that is really alive and well and prospering these days, as more and more American Indians themselves are undertaking studies of their own religions and of Christianity.
We're coming down to the point where we have to finish, and I guess I wonder about also the issue of cultural appropriation, and whether sometimes people, their interest in Native American spirituality is not for what it is, but for somehow what they want it to be. I'm not sure if that's a very clear kind of question, but I think probably an accurate observation.
Well, it's probably true that the what we would call New Age religion can be something that inappropriately appropriates other religious traditions to our own ends. On the other hand, you know, there are different ways of looking at it, and some Native American religious leaders would say and do say that what they have to teach should be open to and relevant to all mankind. And there are others who would say, no, this is only appropriate for people who are Native Americans. So there is a strong difference of opinion on that issue. In terms of spirituality, I find it hard to conceptualize boundaries.
Mm.
And so I find it very hard to be critical. I know what offends me, and I know, you know, what doesn't, but it turns out to be more or less of a personal kind of decision for any individual. For American Indian tribes, it can be a real problem. The feeling, for example, among many Lakotas is that their Sundance is being appropriated by non-Indians. And we have Sundances here in Indiana or Maryland or Oregon, and they find that to be completely inappropriate because it's, for one thing, out of the place, out of the plains, out of the area where it originated. And on the other hand, you will find some Lakotas who say, no, it's totally appropriate. It's no different than Christianity. It's just being taken everywhere. So there's no simple and clear-cut answers. Mm-hmm. But there is this spiritual longing.
Well, we are going to have to stop there, again, with our thanks to our guest, Raymond DeMaley. He's professor of anthropology. He's also director of American Indian Studies, the American Indian Studies Research Institute at Indiana University. And again, if you're interested in reading the book that we have been talking about here, John Neihardt's Black Elk Speaks, it is still in print. And as our guest said, on the web, there's a lot of information about black elk. And then also, if you're interested in reading his book, which takes a look at black elk and the relationship between the two men and goes back to some of the original source material that Neihardt used to write the book, you can also look for his book. That is Raymond DeMaley's book, The Sixth Grandfather. That was published in 1984. It also is still available. Professor DeMaley, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much, David. I enjoyed it.